Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Monday morning, that means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. And my dad will call in a little bit later on and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. We're also going to talk about the coolest, your favorite, and most memorable TV and movie Cars, considering Cars 3 was the number one movie at the box office. We'll talk about the box office a little bit later on. But talk about some of the coolest and best cars in TV and movies. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And you can also text us and talk to us there, as I just said. And 312-981-7200. Check us out on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay. Lots of movies to talk about this week. And Eric Childress and Colin Suter from eFilmCredit.com, RogerEbert.com, and much more in the Chicago Film Critics Association join me every week to review all the new movies. And Eric and I also will talk about box office. And we've got a lot to talk about, so let's welcome the guys to the show. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
All right. Well, let's get to it. None of us saw All Eyes on Me, which is the Tupac Shakur biopic, and we'll talk about how it did at the box office a little bit later on, but none of us got a chance to see that one. Now, they didn't screen that one for the critic, correct?
No, so this is exactly how they want it.
Okay. All right. Let's start with Colin. Why don't you start us off with The Book of Henry? I think you're the only one who saw that.
We're starting here, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Eric, have you seen it? You've not seen it.
I have not.
Okay.
But I cannot wait to hear Colin's review.
Okay.
All right. Well, this stars Naomi Watts as a single mother of two boys, who one of whom is a child genius named Henry. And he's played by Jaden Lieberher. He's the kid from Midnight Special and St. Vincent, that kid.
Mm-hmm.
Younger brother is played by Jacob Tremblay, the kid from Room. So anyway, Henry is a genius. He deals with the family investments and stocks while his mom plays video games. He's investigating his next-door neighbor, played by Dean Norris from Breaking Bad, who might be physically abusing his young teenage stepdaughter. He is investing, he's inventing Rube Goldberg gadgets in the treehouse that he's, that sits in their backyard. And he's undercutting every adult around him in a way that makes you want to punch the little twerp in the face in every scene. Because he is a kid, this kid is really, really smart. We must have him talk like the smartest person in the room. He can't just be a kid who talks like a kid. So, yeah, little man's hate, this is not. Anyway, about a third of the way through the film, Henry is stricken with a deadly illness and doesn't have long to live. So what else? Sarah Silverman is in this film as a coworker of Naomi Watts. They work at a diner together, and Silverman is an alcoholic. Bobby Moynihan plays their boss, and Lee Pace plays the head surgeon at the hospital where Henry is staying, and you can kind of see where that goes. Single mom, single doctor. So, yeah. All of this sounds fairly innocuous and, just sort of border. It sounds like your average kind of Lifetime movie of the week, disease of the week kind of thing. And if that's all it was, that'd be fine, I guess. It's still a really overwritten and underdeveloped script in terms of just the basic subject matters. It seems like this movie was written by a guy who saw all the wrong movies about child abuse, about child prodigies, single motherhood, alcoholism, all those things and more. Saw all the wrong movies about those subjects and then figured he knew everything there was to know about those subjects and then wrote a script. Naomi Watts' performance is so detached from reality. The kid, like I said in the movie, the main, the Henry character is so unlikable, so just it's a screenwriter's idea of what a child prodigy or a child, you know, genius would sound like. He'd sound like, you know, the smartest adult in the room. And so, you know, when the kid is stricken with an illness, it's not, you know, we're not supposed to, you know, we're supposed to feel sad about that. I'm, you know, in a normal movie. Now, again, all of this would be just made for just kind of an incompetent, you know, maybe, you know, a movie that would just doesn't work. However, this movie, about 2/3 of the way through, goes so far off the rails in terms of its storyline. If I told you what happened, you would never believe me. That a writer could conceive of something so stupid and ill conceived and poorly thought out, that and to have a director behind it, like a director like Colin Trevorrow, who is a director that I like. I really like Safety Not Guaranteed, and I think of the three of us, I'm the one who gave Jurassic World the most, you know, the most positive review. Not saying it's great, but I probably enjoyed it the most of the three of us. And this is a huge miscalculation in every respect, that the longer this movie went on, the more shocked and offended I was by where it went, how it was presenting itself. I mean, it's to say it's emotionally manipulative is just scratching the surface. It's using every base technique to be a tearjerker, but also the way it wants to tap into the audience's bloodlust for the next-door neighbor character, a character that is so poorly written that you just don't buy any of it, that the longer it went on, the more I wanted to just punch my head through a wall. I really had a visceral hatred of this movie the more it went on, that when it was over, I just felt ashamed for everybody involved. I haven't felt that way in a long time towards a movie, but this movie really got under my skin in the most wrong way. That this is not only one of the worst films I've seen all year, it might be the worst film I've seen all year. So, yeah.
All right. Okay, The Book of Henry. All I know is I've not seen the movie, obviously, but I have seen the trailer. And the trailer looks crazy because at one point Naomi Watts has a rifle with a scope on it.
Yeah, see, I did not see the trailer for this film at all. I'd read that, you know, that this was a film that was, you know, getting some negative press. And I just thought, well, one of us should go see it. I'll go see it. Just, I'm curious. But, that, you know, that's all I knew. And I wasn't really prepared for where this movie was going to go. So, yeah, the trailer is showing you something that is completely absurd. And this, I can't imagine anybody watching this thing and saying, yeah, I buy this. I buy where this is going. No. It's so bad.
Okay.
Because the trailer even really just focuses mostly on, yeah, kid's a genius, but he's investigating the thing that's going on next door. That's what the trailer seems to suggest it's about.
Yeah.
That's what had me intrigued.
Yeah. Well, there is that. I mean, that does happen.
Okay.
But, the way the film is structured and the way the story is told is just... it's just thoughtless and stupid.
Okay. And by the way, this is the guy that's in charge of episode 9.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying not to let that cloud my excitement of any of the Star Wars movies. I think this could just be, you know, a bad, unfortunate step. We've had a few great directors make this kind of mistake. I mean, this is the second time an indie director or director that has, you know, solid indie roots has made a film that was just really poorly conceived. You know, we had James Ponsoldt with The Circle of last month, which is a film I really didn't like either. You know, it happens. I mean, David Gordon Green made Your Highness.
Yeah, that's true. You know. That's true. Okay. All right, hang on, okay? All right, Eric and Colin are here, and that was a review of The Book of Henry. And Colin hated it. All right, we're going to take a break. We got the news coming up next and then more movie reviews for your Monday morning right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How are you? We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5. And the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday. That means my dad will be calling in to tell a jokey time. And we are doing the movie reviews, the Monday movie reviews, Monday morning movie reviews. And we also, because Cars 3 came out this week, we're also going to talk about your favorite and most memorable movie cars of all time. But we got a lot of movies to talk about, so let's get back. Eric and Colin join me every week to talk movie reviews. And here is Eric. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Eric, tell us about 47 Meters Down.
Okay. Well, this is a shark movie with Mandy Moore. We had a shark movie last summer with Blake Lively. This summer we get one with Mandy Moore, and it involves two sisters who go off on vacation, one of them getting over a bad breakup as part of the reason for the vacation. They are convinced by some locals to go into a shark cage, you know, just for kicks. People tend to do these crazy, stupid things. I don't know why, but they decide to do that. And while they're doing this with the ship captain played by Matthew Modine, that should have been their first clue not to do this, they end up having some problems with the winch, and they are trapped underneath the water 47 meters down, as the title suggests, with sharks circling them and oxygen running out and communication at a standstill until people up above can get them one of any of the number of things they need to survive. That's all you need to know about the plot. I actually think that there is a far more interesting story involving this on how this movie actually got released, because I actually saw this movie an entire year ago.
Hmm.
There was not at any festival or anything like that. This is a movie at the last summer, right before The Shallows was going to come out, and it was called In the Deep, and it was going straight to video.
Mm.
And at the time, it was handled by Dimension Films, which is a division of the Weinstein Company, and it was going straight to video, and I got a screening link for it and watched it. And I'll get to the review in a second, but once the success of The Shallows came down, Dimension sold the rights to Byron Allen's Entertainment Studios. And they're now getting into the theatrical business, and they held this movie back an entire year, changed the title on it, and have now released it into over 3,000 screens. And, you know, so there's that. So is that more interesting than the movie itself? Pretty much. You know, as a straight-to-video movie goes, this is, you know, pretty much a kind of a standard-issued, mediocre story. Not, you know, as if we're going to rank just between that and The Shallows, which I was not a big fan of. The Shallows is much better, much tighter film. It has its share of moments here and there. It has, you know, some potentially interesting ideas. But doesn't really exactly have the kind of strong direction behind it to make this kind of thing really pop and really, you know, become sort of one of the more memorable shark movies. Not that there's a whole lot of them. And then, you know, I don't want to spoil too much, but it does have, you know, Colin wants to talk about third act, you know, twists and things like that. This movie certainly has one of those that people who may have walked out of the theater last week and were very upset with It Comes at Night, I can't imagine how they wouldn't walk out of this thing being absolutely furious. So there's that, yeah. And, yeah, so, I mean, so that's basically it. I mean, it's a mediocre shark movie. It's out in theaters. If you want to see Mandy Moore hunted down by a shark, I would just say wait to its intended audience where it should have been from the first place, straight to video.
Well, that's a crazy story. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I mean, I had heard that it was supposed to go straight to video, but Byron Allen?
Yeah, Entertainment Studios, that's the name of the company releasing this thing, and they didn't go light with it. They were 3,500 theaters.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right in your summation of it. I'm not surprised that it was initially going to go straight to video because it feels like a straight to video film.
Mm-hmm.
From the way it's shot to, you know, the production values of it to who's in it.
Yeah.
This has straight to video all over it. It's not very scary. A couple of okay moments. It's a standard straight to DVD or straight to video movie. And that's what it feels like. And the fact that it got this kind of release and made, what did it make? $11.5 million,
mm-hmm.
which is more than it would have made going straight to DVD. So
yeah.
I guess maybe it was a smart decision on the part.
Yeah, I can't imagine they picked this thing up for, you know, probably more than a couple million bucks
yeah.
from, you know, Weinstein. You know, God knows they need the money.
Yeah. Yeah. And anybody who goes into a shark tank and is not named Hooper is an idiot. So that's mm-hmm. that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
And this is nowhere near as good as I'm actually a big fan of The Shallows. I like The Shallows quite a bit, and this isn't even yeah. the same. So because of the success of The Shallows, that's why we have this.
It seems to be. I'd have to go back and look at the precise timeline, but this was supposed to come out on video, I think, like right before The Shallows. Mm. So even like the video release, like they knew that a shark movie was coming out, so they were, you know, that's how they were timing it.
Yeah.
But then they must have there must have been the sale, or Weinstein didn't. All I know is I got the screening link, and then like 2 weeks later, it was pulled off the release schedule.
Okay. And now it's out. 47 yeah. meters down, and I would say don't. I would say yeah. skip. All right. Now, Colin, you're the only one who's seen the latest Pixar movie.
Hmm.
And that would be Cars 3. I would have gone out of my way to see it had it been a Pixar movie in a series that I like.
Sure. Sure, I understand.
But I don't like the Cars movies, so... it's a $53 million over the weekend, and tell us about Cars 3, Colin.
Right. So, in terms of quality, this is Pixar's definitely their most lackluster franchise. This one, we see the champion race car Lightning McQueen, voiced by Owen Wilson, having his thunder stolen during a race by a new, sleeker, more modern race car named Jackson Storm. Who's voiced by Armie Hammer. And the reason this car is winning races is because it's been trained with more modern technology. And after this horrendous crash during a race that Lightning McQueen has, he figures the only way he can compete against this guy is to try and learn the same lessons that Jackson Storm is learning. So Lightning McQueen finds himself at a modern facility and being trained by, I guess, a female car named Cruz Ramirez, voiced by Cristela Alonso. But Lightning doesn't really take to the modern way of driving. It doesn't suit him, but he needs all the help he can get. And so he does what he can. He flashes back to, you know, words of wisdom from his old trainer, Doc Hudson, who is voiced by both the real Paul Newman. They're using outtakes from the original Cars for him, and as well as a Paul Newman impersonator voicing this character. So you see, it's a very standard sports formula movie. It's the old athlete that is starting to age, and his technique is starting to wear thin, and he's got to be trained by the younger, more sprightly person who has a lot of potential in themselves. So I'm not a fan of the Cars movies either. I thought the first one was just okay. It had moments of charm, but is ultimately pretty, it felt pretty empty, especially for a Pixar film. And then Cars 2 is just one of the worst, if not the worst, Pixar film. Actually, I kind of lean towards Monsters University being my least favorite, but yeah, Cars 2 is just not good at all. This one surprised me. I actually like this film. The reason I like it, one of the reasons why I like it, is because of what it is about. It is about aging. There's something interesting about a film that is aimed at children. This is a rated G film. And making it a film about growing old and realizing that your glory days are going to end someday, and that there is there's a lot to be said for just passing down the torch event at some point. And I like this film because, in comparison to the other two, there seems to be some emotion put into it. There seems to be a little more thought put into
the characters. And so you got the Maynard character from, you know, the Larry the Cable Guy character is more in the background this time. He's not at the forefront anymore. That's a big plus right there. And I also think there's a movie that really gets it right about cars. I mean, just cars in general. This is a film that really knows, or that really makes the audience feel the joy of being a car and just being free to race around, especially, I mean, for this world where we're, you know, investing into these characters that are things that, you know, we drive, but they're become, but they have personalities. And it's kind of a strange concept when you think too much about it. If you got to step back away from the concept and not let yourself get caught up in the practicalities and everything. But I mean, this is still lower tier Pixar. I mean, it is a formulaic film, and it doesn't stray from any formula that we haven't seen before. But it is still, and it's also too long. It's almost 2 hours. It doesn't need to be almost 2 hours. But of the three Cars movies, if you're going to see one, this is the one to see for just the reasons that I mentioned. It feels like the most complete and the most well thought out of the series. So I say it's still lower tier Pixar. It's a 3-star movie. It's, you know, marginally better than The Good Dinosaur, but not as good as a lot of the other. You know, it's not up there with their best by any stretch. But for a Cars movie, it really surprised me, and I liked it.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so Cars 3 recommended, and we'll talk about how it did at the box office a little bit later on.
And also, I also like the short film.
Okay. All right, cool. All right, everybody hang on. Eric, hang on a second. Colin, hang on a second. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we got more movies to review. It's Monday morning, and it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. We're here till 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad will call in and tell a jokey time. We're going to talk about, in honor of Cars 3 being released, we're going to talk about your favorite, most memorable, coolest movie and TV cars ever. And right now we're reviewing the movies, and we'll get to the box office as well. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me every Monday morning for the movie reviews and the box office. And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Eric, why don't you tell us about Abacus, Small Enough to Jail?
Okay. Well, this is the new documentary from the great Steve James, and is the story of the only bank that was ever prosecuted during the 2008 financial crisis for mortgage fraud. But it's clearly not one of the banks that you would expect to be prosecuted. The name of the bank was indeed called Abacus, and it is a small Chinese bank owned by a Chinese family for many years, a Chinatown staple in New York City, very much a community bank. And one of their employees was involved in some shady dealings, making a little cash for himself on the side and screwing some of their customers, unbeknownst to them. And when it became when they became aware of it, they began taking the proper steps to correct it. And obviously, they fire the guy immediately. But the customers took another route and ended up going to the authorities with it. And with that, the district attorney that got involved saw a very easy mark. An opportunity to sort of make a name for himself and sort of make an example of someone during this, this really crazy period in our financial times. And this movie documents the case and, how this district attorney and how justice may not exactly be blind, but it can clearly have its blinders on. And sometimes it's eyes wide open when it sees an easy mark like this and can make an example, especially within the press and stuff like that. So while this film does document a lot of elements about the case, including playing recordings of actual testimony and things like that, because this is a Steve James film, this is very much a story about people. And we really come to know this family and what they were going through during this period. There's obviously there's footage of them you know, working on this case. The patriarch of the bank is 80 years old, and we get to meet, you know, the entire family, and many of them are daughters who not only have connections to the bank but are also lawyers in their own right. So the opportunity for them to sort of, you know, take on the government is, you know, obviously a, you know, not exactly a great, you know, a winnable type of case, but it is something that, you don't get many opportunities to take on in your lifetime. So there's kind of a equal elements of, you know, relishing the opportunity to do this while also knowing full well the dangers of how a government or anyone with money can really take advantage and drag things out and, you know, possibly destroy this family. One of the daughters, in fact, was even working or clerking. I'd have to go back. I don't remember exactly what her position was, but was actually working in this DA office, finding out that they were going to be prosecuting her family at the time. Mm. It's a really, you know, it's kind of a story of our time. I mean, we have The Big Short, so we kind of have the background of exactly what went on during that time, and a little bit of that is documented here, so we get a little bit of the background of this. But it's a story about, you know, like people taking the easiest possible route, and, you know, to make an example. And it's not exactly a compliment about the justice system. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of the stuff go on right now that just doesn't seem right, doesn't seem just. And to watch this family have to go through something like this just to either to make some headlines, or even some of the jurors are interviewed and talk about the conflicts, and some of the jurors wanting to make an example of this bank and this family is really just kind of infuriating at times. But again, because it's Steve James and getting to know these people as individuals, the onus becomes less off the anger element and more of just kind of the empathy towards these people. It's a fascinating legal case. It's a fascinating period of our history, and it's a really fascinating portrait of a family going through a crisis like this. I mean, Steve James is one of the best filmmakers, documentarians we have out there, and this is definitely another winner.
I'm noticing in the cast, Margaret Colin is listed.
I don't remember seeing her.
Okay, she's listed in the. I was like, why is Margaret?
Is the same Margaret Colin?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I'm looking at IBM right now, and it's Margaret Colin from Three Men and a Baby, and all those other, and from Veep.
That's what I'm thinking of right now.
Yeah. So.
I must have blinked and missed her. Yeah. I don't remember seeing her.
Yeah, it's alphabetical, you know.
I don't remember. There's not really like recreations or anything,
right? Maybe she had some stock in the bank or something.
Possibly.
So I don't know, but anyway, I just found that very strange. I mean, all of a sudden there's Margaret Colin as herself. I'm like, oh well, okay.
And I should also mention, like, the film also had kind of bridges itself with, you know, when a movie opens itself with a subject matter like this, and you see the filmmaker immediately try to make a comparison between this guy and George Bailey. Immediately, you start to put your blinders on a little bit yourself and go like, okay, let's, you know, show me that this guy has a connection to George Bailey.
Yeah.
And I'll be damned if there's not a scene in the movie, a scene that happened in real life, where the word gets out that this bank is going to be shut down because of
all
stuff that's going on.
Really?
And everyone runs there for their money.
Oh,
I couldn't believe it. I'm just like, okay,
wow.
You got me, Steve.
There you go. He's a great filmmaker.
Yeah.
And a good man. Okay, Eric, Colin, hang on. We got to take a break. And for the news, and when we come back after the news, we'll review more new movies, and then we'll talk box office as well. It's Nick DiGilio here on Monday morning on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran with your morning drive at 6. Our phone number and text number is 312-981-7200. It's Monday morning. We're in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews. It's Monday. Also means my dad will call in and tell a jokey time, brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. Had a fantastic Father's Day meal there over the weekend. and it was great and lovely as always. And also, because the movie Cars 3 opened, we're going to talk about the best and your most memorable and your favorite TV and movie cars. Right now, we got to get back to the movie reviews. Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me every week. And here's Eric. All right.
Hello.
And here's Colin. All right.
Hello.
Okay, guys, I didn't get a chance this weekend to see The Hero. And I'm very disappointed that I didn't get a chance to see it. We've talked about it before on the show, and it was actually at the film critic at the Chicago Film Critics Festival. And Colin, why don't you tell us about The Hero?
Yeah, so Sam Elliott plays a version of himself, I guess. He's an actor who's been around for a while, best known for being in Westerns, and now he has to carve out a career for himself as, among other things, a spokesman for a barbecue sauce. Laura Prepon from Orange is the New Black plays this unlikely love interest for him. Nick Offerman plays another actor who likes to get high with Sam Elliott a lot. And Kristen Ritter plays Sam Elliott's estranged daughter, and Catherine Ross plays his ex-wife. This is a film about how he tries to bounce back while also confronting his immortality and, you know, what he might be leaving behind when all is said and done. And we've had three movies that are kind of like this, that are sort of conceived as almost love letters to the actors who are at the center of them. We had Lucky with Harry Dean Stanton, which we'll talk about again in a couple months, and Dog Days with Burt Reynolds, which is, this movie is more in common with Dog Days. The two are almost like shot for shot similar. It's very strange how these two films just sort of came around at the same time. But this is sort of, you know, not as good as Lucky, but better than Dog Days. And definitely just worth seeing, especially if you're a big Sam Elliott fan, which of course we all are. This is from the director of I'll See You in My Dreams, which is another really wonderful, touching film about getting older and you know, dealing with, you know, your past, but mostly your present. And Sam Elliott was in that film, too. And this is a director, Brett Haley, who made this film, who really knows how to use this actor in a way that puts him in a film that is based on, you know, emotion and, you know, sentimentality, but without being mawkish or corny. I think this is definitely a film worth seeing.
Okay. All right, Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, I like it too. Everything Colin just said, I mean, that pretty much sums it up. I mean, you know, an opportunity to give Sam Elliott a role like this, and he's got a really fantastic scene, you know, in the midway through the movie, auditioning or practicing for the audition with Nick Offerman that is just about almost as good as, you know, his big scene in Grandma with Lily Tomlin. Offerman's really good. I don't think the relationship with Laura Prepon works quite well in this movie, but Sam Elliott, you know, getting, you know, a chance to take charge of a movie like this and as a love letter to him is quite cool.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Sam Elliott, and I really did want to get out to see it. I just didn't have time on this weekend, but I'm looking forward to it. And I did find it interesting that you guys did have those three movies playing at the fest.
We didn't try to. It just happened that way, you know?
Yeah. Like the Hero, I think, was actually the very first movie we booked for the festival. And then Lucky appeared at South by Southwest a couple months later, and we went after that. And then Dog Years ended up premiering at Tribeca, which A24 just picked up and is releasing. So, yeah, it just worked out that way.
Interesting.
Yeah, I kept calling it Dog Days. It's Dog Years. I just keep doing
dog
that.
Dog Years, okay.
I always do that with that movie.
Okay.
That's also a good movie, by the way.
Okay. Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to that one, too. That's about, you know, Burt Reynolds. You got Burt Reynolds, you got Harry Dean Stanton, you got Sam Elliott. Three guys who we all like.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. All right, well, Eric, since we're in the indie world, why don't you tell everybody about Band-Aid?
Yeah, speaking of movies that played at our festival this year, this is another film that we got from Sundance this year, and it's the written and directed and starring Zoe Lister-Jones, and her and Adam Pally play husband and wife who are in kind of just the midst of that period of a marriage that things are just not clicking. They're frequently having arguments, no one's really winning those arguments, and they're, you know, seemingly about nothing when, you know, they could just be about everything. And each of them have connections with music. And Zoe Lister decides, or they kind of mutually decide that maybe if they take their disagreements and their arguments and turn them into songs, they'll be able to sort of work through these issues as therapy. And they enlist a really quirky neighbor played by Fred Armisen to fill out their band. This movie follows their progress to, you know, turning their arguments into song. Now, it sounds like a kind of a kooky, cheap little gimmick of a movie, but this is not the kind of movie where they're going to win some big prize at the end or enter some big band competition and everything will be solved if they win the big, the big prize at the end. It's not that kind of a movie. It's a comedy. It is a very funny movie, but it is good enough to, you know, to have to treat the subject matter with the level of respect and not treat it like a gimmick, not treat it as an aside, as an excuse to, you know, hang this plot on. It actually treats their issues as real, and it's the kind of thing that gives the screenplay and the performances the necessary gravitas to to show that this is not something that's being taken for granted. The two performances, Zoe Lister-Jones, who I've been a fan of for a long time now. She's been on the indie scene for a while, and she's now really kind of made her way in the television world. I think this is a really good debut for her. I'm an Adam Pally fan, and I think he's really funny in this. And Fred Armisen, his scenes in the movie, is the kind of stuff you wish there was more of, frankly. So he completely, you know, steals all the scenes that he's in. This is a really funny, charming, and sometimes a serious movie that I really hope people take a look at.
Yeah, I really like this movie a lot. It kind of blindsided me. I didn't expect to be as emotionally grabbed by it, because it's a really good film about relationships. It really is. I mean, the arguing, the how the arguments are sometimes settled, how sometimes they're not. The fact that they're exercising their disagreements and their arguments through art, I think, is a really wonderful way to look through it. And I bought all of the like when they were sort of whatever, quote unquote, improvising and writing the songs on the spot. I bought all of that. And I thought the characters were flawed. Both of them were flawed. If you're in a relationship for a while, this movie has a lot of truth in it. there's a lot of painful truth in this movie. And I didn't expect that. It's really well directed. It's beautifully acted. She did a terrific job. I like the script. All the cast is great. It's filled out with a bunch of other supporting cast members that are really good in it too. And I think it's funny, and I think it's honest, and I think sometimes it's painful. It does have a third act, you know, resolution that seems a little bit fast to me. Because you know that there has to be the conflict in order for there to be a resolution.
Right.
And the conflict part seems a little forced to me, but nevertheless, it seems like a very accurate and honest movie about relationships. I thought the songs were good, and I thought the acting was good, and it was entertaining, and it was funny. And Fred Armisen is hilarious in the movie. I mean, like, he was killing me. I mean, everything he did in the movie was gold. And then because they reveal smaller things about it. It's a beautifully written character. She did a great job with this character because they reveal small things about him.
Yeah.
And when you find out what his real problem is and who his best friends are, that's a beautiful and hilarious, like, little take and very strange. And I just thought, you know, Fred Armisen is awesome. And he's a great drummer, and he was the perfect guy to cast in the role. So I really liked this movie a lot. I really did. I liked it very, very much. It's called Band-Aid, a great relationship movie with good songs and lots of funny stuff in it. Really well written and directed by Zoe Lister-Jones, who's also terrific in it. It's playing exclusively at the Music Box, but it's also on VOD. So if you want to watch it, I highly, highly recommend it. Okay, guys, hang on, all right? Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. There's Colin, there's Eric, and that movie is called Band-Aid. It's playing in the Music Box, and it's also on video on demand. And there you go. We got more movies to review right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. Hi, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And we're here till 5 a.m. It's movie reviews. Monday morning movie reviews happen every week. Eric Childress, Colin Suter join me each week to review the new movies. And then Eric will stick around and we will talk about box office. And also, because Cars 3 was released, we will be talking about the best, most memorable, your favorite TV and movie cars. Let's get the guys back here. Eric Childress, Colin Suter. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello.
All right. Colin, tell us about Rough Night.
All right. In this one, Scarlett Johansson plays a woman who is running for state senate, and she is engaged to be married to a guy played by Paul Downs. And she and her friends are going to Miami for a bachelorette party. And Johansson's friends are played by Zoe Kravitz, Jillian Bell, Ileana Glazer, and later on, Kate McKinnon shows up as her friend from Australia. And why not hire an Australian actress to play an Australian? Because she probably wouldn't be as funny as Kate McKinnon. So anyway, a stripper shows up, and during the festivities is accidentally knocked out and killed. And the girls try to figure out what to do next. They hide the body. They clean up the blood. They figure out a way to get the video footage of them taking the dead body out to the beach at night that was caught by a surveillance camera. And I forgot to mention Ty Burrell and Demi Moore are in this as a kind of creepy swinging couple who live next door. So this is definitely something this is made up of a lot of parts of other films that we've seen before. Weekend at Bernie's, The Hangover Trilogy, Very Bad Things, you know, the party that goes horribly wrong because somebody gets killed and we're all trying to hide the body or trying to make the body look alive when people come over, that sort of thing. This is a film that is right in line with a lot of contemporary comedies in that it casts a lot of very talented, funny people in it. And, you know, kind of expects the shortcomings of the screenplay to be compensated by the talent on the screen that, and then the wit and the hilarity that they can bring because of shows like Broad City, which is this is kind of an offshoot of. A lot of people, a lot of the creative team behind that show are in this movie or worked on this film or directed it. It's directed by Lucia Aniello. And I got to say, I've never seen Broad City, so I know. I'm sorry. I have never seen it. I'd like to. I'm sure it's great. I know you're a big fan, but it's one of those things I have not gotten around to yet. It's on my list of things.
It is great. It is great.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this movie is not. And unfortunately, the cast of this film doesn't really do enough to compensate for the sort of pedestrian material that's here. It's written by Aniello and Paul Downs. And Paul Downs' side of the story, I forgot, he plays the woman who's or the guy who's going to marry Scarlett Johansson. And his side of the story is actually kind of funny in that he and his friends are going to wine tastings and doing those sorts of things and not having a big raucous bachelor party. And really, as you would expect, Kate McKinnon pretty much steals every scene in this film. If there's any reason to see this movie, it is for her. Every cut to her is hilarious. Her Australian accent is so terrible. And it's supposed to be. That's kind of what makes it so brilliant, that she's definitely upstaging everybody else on screen. But the rest of the movie, it has more downs than ups. It goes through so many scenarios that we've seen before. It doesn't really add much to them. There are a lot of lulls in this film. It's mostly when McKinnon shows up that the film comes alive and becomes something that might actually be worth seeing. But it's really not, unfortunately. I'll say this. I mean, this isn't a very good movie, but it's much better than any of the Hangover movies. It's certainly better than Weekend at Bernie's 1 and 2. And I guess Very Bad Things. I don't know. I haven't seen that movie in over 20 years. But, yeah, this is just kind of a misfire, but McKinnon, I think, saves it for the most part.
Yeah, I would agree with you most of it. I actually thought the first third of the movie was pretty funny. Like, even before McKinnon shows up, I thought there was some really funny stuff at the beginning of the film. And it is a great cast, and the people who creatively behind it are, you know, do work on Broad City, and the director actually directed a TV movie on Comedy Central called Time Traveling Bong, which was hilarious. But this just doesn't have the same edge or comedy that you would find on Broad City. And I think just by virtue of the plot, that they think that the plot is so edgy because, oh no, it's a dead body. We got to clean up blood. We got to move the body around. And I mean, it is essentially, as you pointed out, Eric, it is, and you pointed out, Colin, it's the same movie as Very Bad Things. It's the exact same plot as Very Bad Things, except it's, you know, the role reversal. There are things in it that made me laugh. Like you said, Kate McKinnon is very funny. There's a section in the movie where she just disappears. You know what I'm talking about, Colin? Like she just, I'm gonna go out on the beach and nap. And then, like, there's an adventure in a car with a dead body, and she's not part of it. I'm thinking to myself, why? This could be a very funny situation. Why not have the funniest person in the movie in that scene? Why, you know, there was, like, that whole stretch of time, like, 10, 15 minutes where she's not on screen. And yeah, you're right. She's the best thing in the movie. I did laugh. I thought the all of the stuff with the guys at the bachelor party, with the wine tasting and all of that stuff was hilarious. I actually thought the whole let's buy Depends, drink Red Bull, and drive down to Florida, I actually thought that was pretty funny. But there are some weird, I mean, there's a scene on the beach involving Ty Burrell and Demi Moore that I found extraordinarily uncomfortable. That just made me feel weird about myself. You know, I was just like, what the hell is happening? I felt very creeped out by that whole scene. And I found Jillian Bell's character to be incredibly annoying, which I understand that's kind of the point, because it's the conflict between Scarlett Johansson and Jillian Bell. They're best friends, and she's jealous of Kate McKinnon. And it is better than the Hangover movies. There's no question about it, Colin. It is, but that doesn't make it good. I thought it had moments. I laughed, you know, a few times. It's not a terrible movie. It's certainly, I'm not recommending it really. But again, Kate McKinnon she's a damn national treasure, man. She really.
I think you guys liked it more than I did.
Oh, you saw it.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, Eric.
Okay.
Oh, we got a break. Hold on, Eric. Hang on. When we come back, you guys will. I didn't see your name there on the list that he saw it. Okay, Eric saw it. So we'll get Eric's thoughts on Rough Night right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How you doing? It's Monday morning, and we're doing the Monday morning movie reviews. My dad will call in and tell a joke, courtesy and sponsored by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. And we're going to talk about your favorite, most memorable TV and movie cars. Eric Childress, Colin Suter, welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
All right, Eric, I didn't mean to jump the gun, man.
No, that's fine.
So what did you think of Rough Night?
I hated it.
Oh, okay.
this is a movie that, you know, on top of everything, I mean, I don't want to add too much to what you guys said, but it's a movie that just has no guts to it. You know, it's not going completely the route that Very Bad Things went to. It does, you know, a tad, and then, you know, it doesn't really want to go to the lengths that the Hangover films went to. Yeah, it's slightly better than those movies, a little more than slightly. But, you know, when you have like a female-led ensemble film, Very Bad Things remake or not, and the most amusing scene in the movie is a wine tasting scene with the guys, that's a problem. You know, and so someone should have recognized that. And, you know, someday someone's going to make a movie other than Ghostbusters that utilizes Kate McKinnon and all her, you know, natural born talents to maximum degree. And this film just doesn't do it. You know, it's a movie that just for the entire film just feels like there's no real stakes involved. At no point during the film is that there's that real sense of danger that any of these women, what they're going through, is going to catch up with them in any way. It feels cartoonish. Just because Scarlett Johansson's character keeps saying that I'm running for Senate, I'm running for Congress, or whatever she's running for, doesn't, you know, add any gravitas to it. You're right about Jillian Bell, who I've found very funny in the past, but here she's kind of doing her shtick, and her character is incredibly unlikable. I mean,
she is,
the only
she's really unlikable. I mean, every time she opened her mouth, I was like, oh, come on.
And the only character that I kind of liked a little, I mean, Kate McKinnon, you know, I just kept waiting for her to make facial expressions to make me laugh, and she kind of made me smile a couple times. But the only character I even, you know, kind of liked a little bit was Zoe Kravitz, because her character at least seems to be kind of grounded in some measure. Only like adult in the room,
right? And she's the one who gets punished the worst.
Yes.
In the movie, like that scene is really, I was like, what?
Like that whole stuff, like the stuff with Ty Burrell and Demi Moore, who like trucked in from some porno movie or something.
Yeah.
Is just not funny. And Lucia, you know, she has no idea how to, you know, to bring all this stuff together. The scene where they go off on the excursion in the car, at that point there's like another body involved, and I was so detached from the movie at that point that I thought it was the new body that they were transferring at that point. I forgot that they left the other body asleep upstairs in the bedroom, and then they try to get even darker towards the end, and that stuff feels so contrived, and you know how that's all going to turn out. I just didn't find this movie funny or entertaining in the slightest.
Okay. All right. Well, none of us are recommending it, but Eric hated it more than the rest of us did. All right, cool. All right, well then, let's see. Eric, why don't you tell us about Beatrice at Dinner?
Okay. Well, this is the latest collaboration between director Miguel Arteta and screenwriter Mike White. And Salma Hayek plays Beatrice of the title, and she is a masseuse, a massage therapist, mostly caters to rich people, including Connie Britton, who is a regular client of hers. And one evening, she is asked to come over to her house for her regular routine, and her car breaks down at the house. And it's on the night of this very big dinner that Connie Britton's husband is having with some business partners that he's having over, a big deal they have just closed. One of those guests includes a character played by John Lithgow, who is an enormous real estate magnate. A lot of people are making comparisons to a certain president person out there right now. They invite her to stay for dinner. She can't leave, obviously, so they invite her to stay for dinner. And she starts having a little too much wine, by her own admission, and she starts engaging in the conversation, particularly with Lithgow's character, who she discovers is a hunter hunting wild game, and might be responsible for putting people and endangering wildlife with some of the projects that he has been involved with. And it leads to a lot of very uncomfortable situations and conversations between this very, humble, angry, massage therapist and the rich folk who are, very condescending and, towards her, and just, it sets up this massive conflict. How is this, the people at this dinner going to survive this night? And all that. So, I mean, that's the basic setup of the film. And, like I said, this is, kind of a comedy or drama, however you want to look at it, whatever side you want to look at it, of manners. And how class warfare is involved in this, liberal conservative ideals, and all of that sounds very heavy-handed. And I suppose that you could look at it in that way. But we just talked about, we just used the word grounded to describe a really bad movie. But in this movie, everything is being grounded by what I think is one of the best performances of Salma Hayek's career. I think she is absolutely terrific in this movie, and grounding this thing in the kind of decency that you want when in being involved in these kind of conversations, and that kind of decency expedites the anger that you have towards people who just don't seem to get it and seem that they're above just kind of normal, decent behavior, and they don't really understand the effect that they're having on other people, as long as they're able to sign on the dotted line. You know, I mean, Lithgow is a guy that I just absolutely adore, and you can, if McKinnon's a national treasure, then John Lithgow absolutely is. And I mean, this guy can, play nice or evil, turn on a dime, anything you need him to do, he's there for. And he just slides right into this role that it's very easy to sort of make comparisons to Trump. I think that might be going a little bit overboard. I mean, you just need to look at him as this rich guy that just seems, detached from all sort of decent human empathy that exists. And there's a real, as funny as this movie can be at times, and including some of the other guests, Chloe Sevigny, I think, is really funny in this movie as well. There's a real underlying sadness that permeates right up to the film's ending really kind of shook me a bit. I really like this film a lot.
Okay. Colin?
Yeah, this is a really terrific film, and just goes to show just kind of how much we've sort of taken Salma Hayek for granted as an actress over the years, and because of a lot of the roles she's been in. She's been in some pretty forgettable movies, but this is the one where, we're kind of reminding of ourselves what a talent she is, and how much she can give to an audience and project being completely silent. We can read so much on her face when she is looking, at Lithgow deeply, looking at him and studying him. And I think Lithgow, the choice of having Lithgow play this part is also key to the movie's success, in that he could have played him in a variety of different ways that would have been really obvious. But he does make this character a little more interesting and more complex by not making him a monster and not making him a caricature of, the kind of person that, the sort of free association we can do with this character. And so, like Eric said, there will be inevitably the viewer will watch this movie and think, oh, this is a Trump parable. And sure, it very well, there's certainly a case to be made for that. And I think we're going to be seeing a lot of movies over the next few years that are obvious Trump parables. And the ones that will succeed are the ones that aren't hammering it to death. They're not beating it down to the audience. And I think this is one of those films that succeeds just mainly as a character study, as a character piece, and not necessarily as an allegory. Although I definitely think this is a really insightful film about the conversation between Latin Americans and Mexican Americans and, white Americans. But it doesn't do so in a heavy-handed or preachy or obvious way. And that's a testament to, I think, Mike White as a writer, who is really one of our best writers working today. Certainly one of the best male writers of female characters. And this movie is a great showcase for that talent. It's a great showcase for all the talents involved in it. So, yeah, definitely worth seeing.
Okay, guys, hang on. We got to take a break, and we'll come back, and I'll give you my review of Beatrice at Dinner, and then we'll talk about the box office as well. We got a break right here. We got weather, and we got traffic, and I got the weather for you here. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And we're going to talk about the box office in just a moment, but we were before the break here, we were talking about Beatrice at Dinner, and Eric gave it a great review, and so did Colin. Welcome back, guys.
Hello. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best movies of the year. I really do, and I think that Miguel Arteta and Mike White are such a great combination. With Chuck and Buck and The Good Girl and the extraordinary TV show Enlightened, for which Miguel Arteta directed, I think, 5 or 6 episodes. And I'm glad, Colin, that you brought up that Mike White is such a strong writer for female characters, because he really is. Just great stuff. Like the Jennifer Aniston's performance in The Good Girl is so great. And Laura Dern on Enlightened, amazing. And don't even get me started on Molly Shannon and Year of the Dog. He's a great writer. He's a great writer at making things uncomfortable. If you guys remember Chuck and Buck was a squirmy movie, a great movie, but like, and The Good Girl was like that too. And he's a great writer at that. This is intelligent. This is great stuff. All the cast members are great. Salma Hayek, I think, should do a campaign to get her an Oscar nomination for Best Actress. I know it's a low-key movie and a short movie and, you know, might not. Eric, what do you think the chances are of her getting recognized for this?
Slim.
Yeah.
Slim, just because of the timing of it,
yeah.
Mostly.
Yeah.
You know, I think there'll certainly be a campaign. I think, you know, it might be, even with Critics Awards, it might be that kind of performance that just kind of gets lost in the shuffle.
Yeah.
It is doing fairly well in limited release right now, so maybe if it can expand a little bit, it'll raise a few more eyebrows.
It was packed when I saw it.
Yeah,
the theater was packed. It's a great movie. I mean, it's just, you know, if you're a fan of Mike White as a writer, this is just, you know, he's a terrific writer, and he's a great director too. But I think that there's, you know, Miguel Arteta is a terrific director as well, and I think their sensibilities are very similar. But the style in which they make movies is completely different, because as a visual director, Mike White is a lot more. He's stranger. Like his choices are strange. There's not a lot of, you know, like in his movies, there are a lot of just like looking right into the camera and talking as opposed to like two shots and things like that. And I think maybe his, you know, I think that Miguel Arteta's style is a little bit more humanistic than Mike White, who seems a little distant in terms of his filmmaking style. But he's still a good filmmaker. I just think he's the right choice. Arteta was the right choice for this movie. And I think it's one of the best of the year. I absolutely think it's one of the best of the year. So I loved it. Go see it. It's playing at the River East. Where else is it playing? Because I saw it at the River East. So
Evanston.
In Evanston and probably Landmark, right?
Yeah, Landmark.
It's playing at the Landmark Century. It's playing at Century 12 in Evanston and the AMC River East right down here, downtown. So there you go. And I think it's one of the best movies of the year, and Salma Hayek is tremendous in it. So is Lithgow, again. You know, that just goes without saying. All right, so next week, does the Big Sick open next week?
Not here.
Oh.
The 30th.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was really looking forward to seeing something that I want to see.
Well, I was saying, unless you're referring to the Big Sick as Transformers 5. Same thing.
It's Transformers, but then there's the movie Maudie, which I'm kind of looking forward to, with Ethan Hawke and, why am I blanking on her name, from
Sally Hawkins.
Sally Hawkins. That looks pretty cool.
Yeah, and at Facets, the film that Amber Tamblyn directed called Painted Black also opens.
Okay. All right. So,
a couple things to look at.
Yeah, just but it's Transformers. Oh my God.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I think it's the shortest of all the Transformers movies, so that's something.
Is it like 158 minutes, I heard?
Is it really?
Oh, yeah.
I thought
2 hours and 28 minutes.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, man. Sorry. Yeah.
God, I thought I saw it was like 2 hours and 9 minutes. I guess I was confused. Oh, you know what? I was confusing it with the Pirates movie. Cuz it was the shortest Pirates movie. This latest one. All right. All right. Well, that's we got that to look forward to.
Ugh. Yep.
All right. Colin, thanks, man.
All right.
All right. There you go. There's Colin. He's going to take off. And Eric, you write about the box office for movies.com. Tell everybody they can see you on TV talking about the money in movies.
Yeah. Every Thursday morning on WYCC television, Business First AM, do a segment called Movies and Money. We talk about the box office and the new releases.
There you go. Let's do that right now. Number one, Cars 3 with $53.5 million. Is that the lowest opening gross for these movies?
Yeah, first one opened to $60 million. Second one opened to $66 million. $244 and $191, I think, were the totals for those. This Cars 3 is probably going to come in the lowest grossing out of all of them.
Okay.
And it's got Despicable Me 3 opening in a couple weeks, so got to make its money now.
Got to make it now, yeah. Number two, I believe the story of the box office again has got to be Wonder Woman. $40.7 million, and that's not a big drop either.
No, that's crazy. It's a crazy drop. As a matter of fact, it's like it's the fourth best third weekend for a superhero movie. Mm. We're talking like Avengers, Spider-Man, and something else I'm blanking on, but like top 11 or 12 third weekends ever. I mean, we're not just talking about like, you know, $300 million, which is obviously going to happen by next weekend. We're talking possibly the biggest film of the summer right now.
Yeah.
It's the last weekend. It was $47 million or off the pace of Guardians of the Galaxy. This week it's only $26 million.
I got to tell you, that's
so gaining.
Yeah, that's crazy, and it's yeah. I really don't think it's going to slow down either.
You know? No, I don't. I mean, Transformers is not going to knock it too far down its perch. Mm-hmm. And then the week after that, I mean, you got Despicable Me 3 and the House and stuff. So I mean, I don't think this thing really starts taking a dive until Spider-Man opens.
Right. Wow. That's amazing. It is amazing. I got to say, man, I went to the movies this weekend, and at the theaters that I went to, they were kids, little girls running around with their Wonder Woman shirts on.
Hey, good for them.
And there were a ton of people there, man. I mean, people are embracing this movie. So.
They certainly are.
Yep. Number three, All Eyes on Me with $27 million. That's pretty strong, right?
That's very strong.
Yeah.
One of the biggest mysteries of the summer for me. I thought that this film could either tank or do something like this. Because clearly they're trying to, tailor the success of Straight Outta Compton and
right.
try to, and they didn't, think much of it because they didn't screen it for critics. It's like 24% at Rotten Tomatoes or something like that. And I hear nothing but awful things about it.
Yeah.
But you released the Tupac movie on Tupac's birthday.
Yep.
You already got a little bit of advertising right there. So, people, went out and embraced it. We'll see how it drops next weekend.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, listen, we'll talk to you next week. We've got the wonderful Transformers movie.
Yeah.
That's 10 hours long.
Yeah, we can't wait.
All right, cool. All right, man, I'll talk to you next week.
See ya.
Thank you, buddy. There you go. Eric Childress, everybody. And they'll be back again. Eric and Colin will be back again to talk about the movies and the box office and all that sort of stuff. All right, we got a break here. We got the news coming up, and then we're going to talk about the most memorable, your favorite TV and movie cars. Right here on WGN.